Buy low, sell high. Very easy to say, but not always so easy to do. For example, high interest rates are hurting the real estate market right now. Demand is dropping and prices in a lot of markets are falling, even for many of the best assets. So it's no wonder the Fundrise flagship fund plans to go on a buying spree, expanding its $1 billion real estate portfolio over the next few months. You can add the Fundrise flagship fund to your portfolio in just minutes and with as little as $10 by visiting fundrise.com/pockets. Fundrise.com/pockets. Carefully consider the investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses of the Fundrise flagship fund before investing. This and other information can be found in the fund's prospectus at fundrise.com/flagship. This is a paid advertisement.
You're trying to close on your next rental, so why is your insurance company dragging its feet? With long lead times and never-ending paper forms, it's no wonder it takes forever to finally get a policy. Modern investors deserve better. They deserve Steadily.com. At Steadily.com, you'll get fast, affordable landlord insurance available online 24/7 in just a few clicks. You can even get next-day coverage, which takes just minutes, by the way, to obtain. And you can do it all from your phone. Steadily was founded by landlords who created insurance products tailored to the unique needs of this industry. It's their sole focus, and that's why landlords nationwide consistently rate them 4.8 out of 5 stars. So whether you've got a single family, short-term, or multifamily portfolio, Steadily.com can secure the best coverage at the best price to protect your properties. Discover how Steadily can save you both time and money on your rental property insurance. Visit Steadily.com for a commitment-free quote tailored to your needs today. The dream of owning a vacation home can be daunting. From finding the best guests, to the maintenance, to organizing the cleaners after every guest day, with Vacasa, they make that dream into a reality. As a full-service vacation home management company with vacation homes in key destinations across the U.S., they know a thing about how to make owning a vacation home easy and profitable. On top of proactive property maintenance visits by professional local teams, a hospitality-driven booking platform, and around-the-clock support, Vacasa earns homeowners an average of 20% more revenue from their vacation homes. Vacasa is always thinking of ways to simplify the vacation home owning experience by putting your home to work for you. If you're looking to make more from your vacation home, work with the reliable property manager, and finally have peace of mind, partner with Vacasa at vacasa.com/biggerpockets. That's vacasa.com/biggerpockets.
Hey everyone, welcome to On the Market. I'm your host, Dave Meyer, and today I'm going to be joined by an incredible guest, Joe Bruzuelas, who is the principal and chief economist for RSM US. And he is going to be talking about a topic that isn't immediately obviously relevant to real estate investors, but it's super important. And that is the labor market. And if you've been following the news, you've probably seen that despite tech layoffs that have really made a lot of splashy headlines, in January, which is the last data we have for the job market as of this recording, there was an unexpectedly large number of jobs added, over 500,000. And this obviously impacts every one of us because we, most of us, want jobs and have jobs. And whether or not there are layoffs and how the economy is growing is super important. But the labor market is also really fundamental to what the Federal Reserve is doing right now. And obviously, as real estate investors, we care a lot about what is going on with the Fed and what they're doing with interest rates. And just before we have Joe on, I just want to re-explain something we've talked about a few times on the show, but I just want to make clear is that the Federal Reserve, their mandate from Congress is twofold. They have two jobs. The first, on one hand, they call it price stability, which is basically fight inflation, right? Don't let inflation get out of control. You want stable prices. Their target right now is 2% growth per year. That's what the Federal Reserve targets. On the other hand, they also want to ensure maximum employment. They want as many people working as possible. And these are their two jobs. And sometimes they work really well together, right? Since the Great Recession until the pandemic, they were doing really good. We had relatively low unemployment. We had low inflation. That was great for the Federal Reserve. It made their job relatively easy. Now, over the last couple of years, it's gotten a lot harder because we have two things going on. We have inflation going up so rapidly that many economists, and we'll hear Joe's opinion about this in just a minute, many economists feel that we need less employment to control inflation. And I'm not saying that's what I want. I don't want anyone to lose their job. But a lot of economists believe that the key to fighting inflation is to increase the unemployment rate. The thought here is that if you increase the unemployment rate, fewer people have less spending power, they spend less money, that puts downward pressure on demand and prices, basically. So a lot of people think that, but a lot of the Fed's intention with raising interest rates is to, you know, create what they call, quote unquote, they have this word for it, like slack in the labor market, quote unquote, basically means more people losing their jobs. So the Fed is basically hoping, it's not what they want, but they're basically saying that they are so worried about inflation being bad that they're willing to sacrifice their other mandate. They're willing to increase unemployment in that effort. The problem is that nearly a year after their first interest rate hike, it's not working. The unemployment rate is extremely low. And frankly, I don't fully understand why, which is why we invited Joe onto the show. Joe has been an economist for 20 years. He's got a lot of really interesting opinions about what's going on in the labor market. And obviously, Joe doesn't know for sure, but he is an expert on this topic and studies it a lot. And what he talks about will have a really big implication on what happens with interest rates. And the housing market obviously follow those interest rates decisions. So I found this super interesting, gave me a lot to think about. I hope you enjoy it. So we're going to take a quick break, but then bring on Joe Bruzuelas, the chief economist and principal for RSM US.
Remember when you had to pay to get a lead's phone number? It was like the dark ages until Deal Machine made skip tracing a thing of the past. Now, with your Deal Machine plan, you'll get unlimited access to phone numbers and contact information for no extra cost. That's right, get high quality, reliable information trusted by leading financial institutions, all fully compliant with the federal Do Not Call list. Explore over 150 data points, including age, gender, marital status, occupation, and a ton more. Trust me, this is the data you need for off-market deals. With new filters, people flags, and color-coded phone numbers, lead management just got a ton easier. Ready to step up your investing game? Sign up for a Deal Machine plan today and gain immediate access to this unlimited treasure trove of contact information and phone numbers. Just head to dealmachine.com/BP. Transform your lead generation and deal-making strategies with Deal Machine. Sign up today and start exploring the unlimited possibilities at dealmachine.com/BP.
Spring into healthier habits this season with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Their fresh, never-frozen meals are chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. It's delicious without the dishes. With more daylight, sometimes it can be easy to lose track of time and get behind on things like dinner prep, but not anymore. Factor's 35 weekly options include different diets like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or vegan and veggie meals, and they keep you fueled and feeling good no matter your schedule. If you're looking for gourmet meals, Factor has those too. You can try meals with premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, and broccolini. You can customize your meals with the flexibility to get as little or as much as you need. And discover more than 60 add-ons you can have every week, like breakfast or on-the-go lunch, snacks, beverages. So no matter what, you're always eating right. Head to factormeals.com/market50 and use code MARKET50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code MARKET50, MARKET50, at factormeals.com/MARKET50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Top real estate investors love to talk about how they save so much on taxes. But how are they able to build rental property empires while skirting Uncle Sam? 1031 exchanges. 1031 exchanges allow you to defer capital gains taxes while you sell an investment property, exchanging your old property for a bigger, better one and avoiding the tax man while you do it. And that's where First American Exchange Company comes in. They're the leaders in 1031 exchanges. Whether you're a seasoned investor or just starting, First American Exchange can help you with simple rental property exchanges, complex commercial real estate investments, reverse exchanges, and more. Don't let your taxes eat into your profits. Visit First American Exchange Company at firstexchange.com. Or call them at 800-556-2520. That's firstexchange.com or 800-556-2520. Keep your money in your pocket and propel your portfolio further at firstexchange.com. First American Exchange Company does not provide tax or legal advice. Consult your financial, real estate, tax, or legal advisor about your circumstances. First American Exchange Company. Safe, smart, secure.
Joe Bruzuelas, welcome to On the Market. Thanks for being here.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
So we're excited to have you on because we can't make sense of the labor market. So we're hoping you can help us understand what is going on. So can you give us a high-level summary of how you see the labor market right now?
Sure, a couple things. The first is, you know, between 1945 and 2015, the labor market grew at about 1% per annum. Given the shocks we went through in the great financial crisis, all of the things that followed, plus the shocks in the pandemic, the labor force is now barely growing. We're talking 1 to 2/10 of a percent per year. We're simply not producing enough native-born replacement workers. And so we've reached a situation where the labor market is going to remain historically tight for the foreseeable future. Let me put that in a context for you. So we only need to produce about 65,000 new jobs a month to meet demand. That's very, very low. Right now, I think even notwithstanding the 517,000 jobs, quote unquote, that were created in January, the underlying rate of job creation is about 200,000 a month. So we just really have a very tight labor market. Now, for many of your listeners, they're probably thinking, what's this guy talking about? All I read are how all these people are getting laid off, how intentions of hiring are slowing. Well, you know, when you take a look at the underlying condition of the labor market, the median duration of unemployment is 8 weeks. So if I see 250,000 or so people have been laid off in tech, why aren't they showing up? Well, not only are we not producing enough people, the people we are producing don't have the requisite skill sets that are necessary to meet where the demand is. So those people who've lost their jobs in tech, they have two choices. They can trade down, take a little less money, stay in tech, or then go work in the other portions of the real economy where those skill sets are incredibly in demand. And they're going to find very good employment at very good wages, triple to quadruple what the average American probably makes. So that's how you sort of square the circle, right? That labor market is tight. It's going to remain tight. Here's the important thing. Wages are not going to increase at 1.5 to 2% per year, like we grew accustomed to between 2000 and 2020. They're probably going to be in that 3 to 4% range, and that's good for workers, right? But that'll be a challenge for businesses who are now adjusting to this historically tight labor market.
And so it seems like this problem has become more acute recently, when if the source of the issue, as you say, is sort of a lack of native-born Americans, why is it sort of all coming to a head right now?
Well, you know, in 2017, we really began to tighten immigration policy on top of the tightening that occurred really since 9/11, right? And so the typical solution in my lifetime when labor's gotten tight is we go ahead and we begin importing workers, right? Either through the H-1B visa, or we increase legal immigration, or we just basically de facto legalize the illegal workers, right? So when you tighten up on all those things, you get in the situation that we're in. That's why over the last several years, labor market has become somewhat tight.
So when we look at the unemployment rate in the U.S., I often get a lot of questions about this. I'm hoping you can clear it up for us. How is it calculated? And does it factor for people leaving the labor market and people having two jobs? Or how can you just explain to us how it works?
Right. So the monthly employment report is two separate surveys, the establishment and the household. The unemployment rate is derived from the household survey. It does account for people who exit the market, who exit the market permanently, right? And it attempts to see who is out of the market but looking for work, right? And then it does population adjust the number. So we get a pretty good sense of who's working and who's not. Now, is it perfect? It is not. But it's the best we have for now. I think the important thing to understand is, as wages have increased over the past 3 years, following the shocks of the pandemic, we've drawn people back in to the point where we've got more people working than we ever have just on a nominal basis, even if the employment to population ratio remains basically, you know, 60%, right? So we're in a situation where the people who are now coming back to the labor market, their skill sets have atrophied, their professional networks are almost non-existent, and they often need vast and deep retraining to make sense. And so this is adding cost onto the firms who now are really having a difficult time finding qualified workers. You can find workers, but can you find qualified workers that you don't have to train or retrain at an increased cost to your operation?
Got it. Thank you. So, you know, most people assume, I'm one of these people, that as interest rates have risen, that we would see larger percentage of firms laying off workers and that we would start to see the unemployment rate tick up, but we're seeing it move in the other direction. Can you help us make sense of that?
Okay. Well, one is again, it's what I outlined earlier, right? Population, the increase in the population of the labor force just isn't growing the way it did before. And that's creating an imbalance. Okay. Second, economists like myself do a terrible job at explaining the long and variable lags on the real economy from interest rate hikes. Now, historically, it would take 1 to 2 years. Now, it's starting to show up in dribs and drabs, right? We can see it.
And is that a year? Sorry to cut you off, but is that like a year to 24 months from the first hike? Because we're not even at a year for the first hike.
Yeah, from the first hike and each successive hikes.
So, yeah, so this could be years in the future.
Yeah, we had 6 supersized hikes in the middle of last year. They're just barely beginning to show up, mm-hmm. right? And second, we've had some labor hoarding, especially in tech and especially in real estate construction. And it makes sense. In tech, it's because we don't have people with those scientific math and engineering skills, right? In labor or in the construction industry, it's because we cut off the immigration valve. So it's very difficult to find anybody to work. I built a home in Austin, Texas last year, early over the past 2 years. It took a long time to do.
That must have been a challenge. Yeah.
It was very difficult to find people to do the work, much less the supply chain issues where I had to put all kinds of things that I wouldn't normally put in the house because that's what was available, right? And that added a secondary layer of cost once things begun to get available, right? But those are first world problems. That's not really something we got to concern ourselves with mm-hmm. in the economy. So the combination of labor hoarding and immigration policy has created a situation of constraints in the overall economy.
Could you just explain to everyone what labor hoarding means?
Sure. What it means is that the tech economy and the life sciences economy runs on a separate and distinct logic compared to the one that you live in. They are so flush with cash that when they find employees, they'd rather keep them in order to meet expected increases in demand, even if that means they don't have enough to do with them.
Wow.
So that's why in 2022, you saw tech in the last 6 to 8 months of the year released some of their workers back into the workforce. It's about 250,000, a little bit less. But those people aren't showing up on the unemployment rolls because, hey, if you can hire them, you probably should because they can do some incredible things that your workforce probably can't.
That's super interesting. So the cost of eventually replacing these people is higher than holding on to them through a recession.
You just nailed it. The cost of letting them go is so expensive, you're better off keeping them. And we're beginning to hear that more and more inside the real economy, outside the supercharged areas of life sciences, tech. You know, obviously, we see what's going on in artificial intelligence. And so right now, it's very difficult to let somebody go. You don't want to because it's going to cost more to replace them.
That's fascinating. But it sort of makes sense given this sort of challenge that people have had hiring over the last few years. There's definitely some, I'm sure, some reticence to let people go because they've seen just how difficult it can be to rehire.
The last time we saw this was at the end of the 1990s during the dot-com era. I remember going to the grocery store and the unemployment rate was in the mid-threes and and it was difficult to hire people. And I remember the person who back then who would have bagged your groceries was basically been out of workforce for a good 10 to 15 years and looked at me like, am I supposed to be doing this? And I'm like, well, yeah, this is, I think, what you'd be doing. And they didn't know how, right? They were mixing up things. They were putting the eggs on top, that sort of thing. You know, it's been a long time since we've been in a situation where labor is just this tight. And it's natural that you're, A, you're asking these questions, and B, the public is growing a little bit restless because the explanations we're providing don't match up with their historical experience. And we just haven't seen this in over a generation.
So given that you're saying there's this lag of 12 to 24 months from each successive rate hike, do you expect unemployment to go up over the course of the year?
Well, historically it was. I think it's a bit sooner for these reasons. One is transparency out of the central bank. We know what they're doing in almost real time. B, large-scale asset purchases are what journalists call quantitative easing, the use of the balance sheet. Really impacts the real economy in very different ways because the Fed didn't do that prior to the great financial crisis. And then three, the structural changes in the market mean financial markets are much more important vis-a-vis the banks, right? So we get a much shorter time span. So yeah, it is going to start to show up. Okay, where will it show up? Here we go. Here's the thing you can take with you, Dave, and hang your hat on. In the housing market, there are currently, through the end of January, 1.7 million homes under construction. And that's just about what we need to, because we got a big shortage in overall the overall stock of housing. We need a lot more housing and we need it quickly. But housing starts and housing permits imply a run rate of 1.3 million at an average annualized base pace. So as those homes get completed and we decelerate down to that 1.3 million, you're going to see a lot of men, 25 to 54, discharged and looking for work in the open market. That will make the unemployment rate go up. Now, I want to say this, and this is really important. The economy will slow, but it's not yet certain that we're going to go into recession. If we do go into recession, it's going to be modest, and it will not have unemployment rates that you would normally associate with a recession. Now, you're a younger guy, Dave. You remember two recessions, the pandemic, where it went to 14%, and the great financial crisis, where it went to 10%. We're not going to get anywhere near that. Mm-hmm. We're talking 5%. That would have been considered full employment 20 or 40 years ago.
Interesting.
Right? So again, to circle back, those demographic changes have now come home. It's altering our own understanding of how the economy works and what constitutes full employment. We have a 3.4% unemployment rate. My estimation of full employment is 4.4%. Okay. Right? When I was in college, it would have been 6%. Indeed, times passed and things have changed and they require new policies.
You hit on something, I want to get back to the labor market, but you hit on something about a recession and that it might be a mild one. I think one of the common questions we have from our audience is, how do you define a recession? Let's ask an economist.
Okay, I can tell you, it's easier to talk about what it's not. It is not two consecutive quarters of negative growth. We define recession in the United States economy very differently. It's a broad and synchronized decline across a number of discrete economic variables such as employment, retail sales, wholesale sales, industrial production. We could go into it deeper, but that essentially nails what a recession is. And here's what the difficulty is. If one were to look at, say, housing, I think it's pretty honest we're in recession right now, even if the unemployment's not there, because residential investment declined by 26.7%.
Wow.
in the fourth quarter, right? Manufacturing is very close. It either is or soon will be. But you look at tech, you look at life sciences, you look at the broader service sector, not so much, mm-hmm. right? I travel a lot as an economist. The best part of my job is I get to go around the North American and global economies. I'm not stuck in the glass skyscraper as I was for many decades. It's made me a better person and a better economist. I get a good idea of what's going on out there. Try going to an airport right now. Just try. It's a difficult proposition. I mean, yeah. There's no recession at the airport, right?
No way.
It's happened.
Oh my God, it's crazy.
Right?
Yeah.
So if we do have a recession, we're going to have a non-synchronized recession, or what some might call a rolling one. Yeah.
So this, that, okay, rolling one, because that makes me wonder, like, what purpose or what use does the word or term definition of recession mean then? If it isn't ubiquitous across the economy, like, should the average American really care if we're in a quote unquote recession or not? Or should we really just be thinking about the individual sectors of the economy that impact our individual lives?
Okay. There's two things here. There's the public and then there's investors. The public should care, because when you do get that downturn, you will get an increase in unemployment. Mm-hmm. And remember, one person's recession is another person's depression, right? Mm-hmm. Now, if we're talking about investors, that's a different thing. We definitely need to be looking at the different ecosystems out there, right? Because they're going to have different realities. And the deeper you dive down to the zip code level, the different outcomes you're going to have. I live in Austin, Texas. My job is in New York, basically. I'm all over the place. I live in the tech utopia, mm-hmm. but this Austin's the boom town. We don't have enough people to fill the jobs. The unemployment rate's in the low twos, right? We don't have enough homes to meet the needs of the people who live here. We don't have enough people. So, right, that's going to be very different than Huntsville, Alabama.
Right.
Right. Or Kansas City, Missouri, or Kansas City, Kansas, for that matter. So, yeah, it really does matter. Whether we're in a recession or not. Now, before the time you and I inhabited this, the third stone from the sun, federal governments, that is the fiscal and monetary authorities, did not respond the way they do now. It was thought that, well, markets automatically clear, markets are perfect. And what the best thing we should do is nothing. Just let the market clear, liquidate stock, liquidate labor, liquidate everything, because that'll get us back on the virtuous cycle. Well, we had some problems along the way, and markets are not perfect. They don't perfectly adjust. I know for some people those are fighting words, but that's just the way that is these days. And we need to be able to identify when the economy slowed down in order to use the balance sheet of both the fiscal authority and, if necessary, not always the case, but if necessary, the monetary authority, the central bank, in order to stimulate the economy, to get the animal spirits moving again and create the conditions for a resumption and expansion of overall economic activity.
That's a great segue to my last question about monetary policy. Given what you said at the top of the show, that a lot of this is demographic driven and that we have basically too many jobs right now for the working population, how difficult is the Fed's job going to be? They seem particularly concerned about wage growth, which you said would be 3-4%. And, you know, a lot of people are saying they need to, quote unquote, break the labor market before they stop raising rates. So how do you see this all playing out?
There's a couple of things here, and this discussion works on or travels on a couple of different levels. The first thing is the Fed does need to generate additional labor slack in order to cool the economy. We were looking at the employment cost index through the end of the fourth quarter, it's up 6.3% on a year ago basis. That's clearly too strong. And that's on the edge of wage price spiral terrain. So policy needs to move in further into restrictive terrain. And that means the policy rate's going to increase. We think three consecutive 25 basis point increases in March, in May, and in June. That'll bring us to a potential peak of 5.5%. with risk of moving higher. It's going to depend on the evolution of the data. Now, the problem here is that the inflation that we're seeing is a bit different than that which we're going to see going forward. Most of the inflation we've seen has to do with the supply shocks unleashed by the pandemic, and then the policy response put in place to mitigate those shocks. April 2020, unemployment rates at 14%. You know what? These inflation problems are well worth an unemployment rate at 3.5% as opposed to 14%. So I do the same thing over again, essentially, perhaps with some small differences on the margin. Now, as the goods inflation has turned to deflation, we're now shifting to demand for services, hence why it's a problem at the airport or at the mall or the grocery store, right? Because demand's still strong. That's where we have to deal with what's going to be higher unemployment through the middle, that'll start in the middle of the year and increase probably through the end of next year. Now, there are things going on with respect to the supply side of the economy that don't have to do with monetary policy or fiscal policy, that have to do with some of the broader economic and strategic tensions out there in the world. It's very clear that at the very least, we're going to be engaging in selective decoupling from China. The G7 are clearly moving in that direction. That means goods, specifically higher priced, sophisticated goods, are going to get that much more expensive. And those are going to be passed along here in the United States. That means that 2% inflation target is likely to give way to a 3 or perhaps 3.5 or 4% inflation target, because we just don't have enough people. And we're engaging in this decoupling from hyperglobalization to a globalization that's defined by regionalization. Well, that means rates are going to be higher than what they've been for the past 20 years. Most of your lifetime, what you know is inflation at around 1 to 1.5% per year, and very low interest rates that in real terms are negative. That's not going to define the next 20 years for you. You're going to be moving and living in a very different time, a very different era. Essentially, the era of 1990 to 2020, the era of hyperglobalization, has effectively come to an end. We're moving into a different era that requires different policies and, quite frankly, different people with different analytical frameworks and economic models. So we're going to have a pretty big turnover here. And that's why your question about why the public should care is spot on. But the public is different from investors, right? And so the two right now are traveling on parallel lines.
All right. Well, Joe, thank you so much for being here. We really appreciate you joining us. Hopefully we can have you back someday to expand on this topic a bit more.
Sure. Thank you very much.
All right, big thanks to Joe for being here. Obviously, the labor market is not my area of expertise, but I've been trying to learn a bit more about it, given its importance in what the Fed is doing in monetary policy in the U.S., and because that has huge impacts on the real estate market, I really want to understand more. And I think the main takeaway for me is that the interest rate hikes that have been going on for nearly about a year right now are really just starting to be felt in terms of the labor market. And although we're seeing these sort of surges in jobs recently, it's probably, according to Joe, Joe thinks that we're going to start to see the unemployment rate tick up over the next couple of months, you know, starting probably mid-year is what he said. And as a result, that should help inflation. That is Joe's opinion. I think that's an interesting, good take. We're obviously don't know what's going to happen, but I think he is very informed and offered some really interesting opinions there. So thank you all. Hopefully you like this episode. If you have any questions about it, you can always hit me up on Instagram, where I'm at The Data Deli. We appreciate you listening, and we'll see you next time for On the Market. On the Market is created by me, Dave Meyer, and Kaylin Bennett. Produced by Kaylin Bennett. Editing by Joel Esparza and Onyx Media. Research by Pooja Jindal. And a big thanks to the entire Bigger Pockets team. The content on the show On the Market are opinions only. All listeners should independently verify data points, opinions, and investment strategies.
There's a reason why small multifamily investing is so popular in the Bigger Pockets community. With just a 3.5% down payment, you can own up to 4 different units. Think about it. If you house hack and live in one of the units, you still have 3 different groups of tenants helping you pay down your mortgage each month, 4 kitchens and bathrooms you could renovate to increase your property value, 4 different Airbnbs, medium-term rentals, or other rental strategies you can try in one property, all in just one transaction. Of course, the question is, where do you find a small multifamily property you can afford? Which market and which deal is best for you? Once you close, how do you manage it, optimize it, keep scaling and living your life without being tied down by 4 leaky toilets or 4 fussy tenants? All great questions. All to be answered in the upcoming Small Multifamily Bootcamp with Chris Lopez and Lika Devatha. So, if you're serious about growing your portfolio with this highly efficient strategy, head to biggerpockets.com/4 today and join us in the Small Multifamily Bootcamp. That's biggerpockets.com/4. See you there.